Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Hi, everybody. My name is Glenn, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm glad to be sober, and in the words of a famous American, who henceforth I shall refer to as my sponsor, I'm glad to be anywhere, fully clothed in my right mind. You know? I'd like to extend to David a thank you for David and his committee, if you got one, which I doubt, but for allowing me this opportunity to be able to participate in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm really grateful. I consider it a privilege just to be able to attend a meeting of AA. I don't think it's my right to be here. I used up my rights a long, long time ago. And I'd like to extend a happy birthday to all those people that picked up the chips tonight. I think it's terribly important that you share your sobriety date. It shows the new guy that Alcoholics Anonymous works. And I'd like to welcome those people in the first 30 days here tonight. I hope you hear something tonight or talk with somebody. They'll keep you sober and bring you back to another meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And now I'm going to tell you the three most important things in my life today. And it'll probably take me 2 or 3 minutes to tell you that. It'll be the best pitch I can give, and I could go home, and so could you. I haven't had a drink of alcohol or any other chemical that affects me from the shoulders up since December 29th, 1963. And for that, and the only thing I did in that 41 plus years, Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm an alcoholic and nothing else. You know, and I'm not in, just because I'm sober 41 plus years doesn't give me any special privileges. I'm not an expert on Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not an expert on the steps. I'm not an expert on the traditions. I love both of those things, and they're the most important thing in my life today. But I'm just another A member. That's all. I have no special rights around here. And for those whole 41 and a half years, I've always had a home group. I started out on the East Coast, and probably the one reason I'm here tonight is I, for about 20 years of my life, from 1980 until 2002, my home group was Nursery Group Number 3 in Walnut Creek, California, which I understand that you've been subjects to a whole bunch of people kind of cluttering up your podium from up here. Don't you think Nursery Group is a wonderful name for a bunch of alcoholic men? I get visions when I first heard about that of guys like me sitting around in a sandbox with pails, you know. And it did so well by me 3 years ago, I moved to the desert. And now my home group is the Palm Desert Men's Book Study Group on Tuesday night. And we meet in the Foundation for the Retarded. And I fit very nicely there. Thank you very much. And I always have had a sponsor. I had a guy appointed, except for the first maybe 60 days I was here. When I was about 2 months sober one night, the guy has appointed himself my sponsor, and maybe if I have time, and I'll share some of that with you. One of the things David mistakes he made tonight, he said, Glenn, you can talk for as long as you want. You guys got no idea how long you're going to be here tonight. But somebody else set me straight. And if there's anyone I have to tell you, if anyone came here tonight expecting to hear a racy, drug and sex-filled story, you're in for a long night. I'm just an old drunk. Through the grace of God, a whole bunch of other stuff ended up at Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've always had a sponsor for these last 41 years, I pointed out. And I'll tell you how important I am. The sponsor I have today, I've known him for something over 35 years. But he's only sponsored me for the last 10 years. And for the first 25 or so years that I knew him, he always called me Gene. And my real name, my full given name is Glenville. But Johnny always called me Gene. And he was talking, I was living in Danville on my 29th birthday. And amongst other things, he came up to talk on my birthday at the Danville speaker meeting. And we played golf with a couple guys that afternoon. About a second tee or someplace, he said to me, Gene, you're up. And I said, I know it. And when I was addressing the ball, I could hear one of the other guys say, Johnny, his name is not Gene, it's Glenn. Johnny said, I know his name is Glenn. I hit the ball and he said, nice hit, Gene. I went to that meeting that night and he kept referring to me from the podium. And finally, one of the guys that was sitting next to me was a speaker here a few months ago, a guy named Steve B., who I loved dearly. Steve leaned over and whispered to me, is he referring to you? And I said, yeah. And Steve said, why is he calling you Gene? And I said, the faintest idea. He said, don't it bother you? And I said, no. He said, why? And I said, well, for two reasons, primarily. One reason, he's been sober longer than I have, and he can call me anything he likes, I guess. You know? And the second reason, when your name is Glenville, Gene sounds pretty good, you know? And about 10 years ago, I had a sponsor in Eugene that got real sick. So I knew I needed a new sponsor, and I went down and asked Johnny. And a couple of weeks later, I was standing at his home group, the Bellflower Big Book Group, which is a big speaker meeting. And I told the story that I just told you. And all of a sudden, I looked out at my sponsor, Johnny's sitting over here, third seat on the right, which I like to refer to as his seat throne. And he was staring at me, and I intuitively knew why he called me Gene. Johnny speaks all over the United States. A lot of people know Johnny. Most people think Johnny is a California native, but he's not. He's from Kansas. And Gene is Okie for jackass. And I said that from the podium, and then I thought, oh, my God, you know. And I looked over, and his face was just like a spotlight. It just lit up. And he's got these great big blue eyes. You know, they're about that big, and they were just dancing. And I could see him say, oh, you finally figured it out. my real name is Glenville. And I used to hate that name. I just hated being Glenville. I kind of love it today. Most of the guys that I know that I sponsor call me Glenville. And a lot of my friends do. Just takes me a long time to say it. That's why I ain't on. But I was looking through some papers. I hope to go to the International in Toronto, and because of some things in my past, I need to get some permission to get into Toronto. I was looking for some paperwork I had. This is about 4 months ago. And I came up on my baby book. It was in a box I hadn't opened in probably 30 years. And I opened it up, and on June 14th, 1940, my sixth birthday, my mother had written this. She said, Glenville has been diagnosed by Dr. Ryan as having St. Vitus dance. He appears to always be irritable and restless. I was 6 years old. I was 9 years from my first drink. And he was describing what is said in the doctor's opinion. You know, I don't know whether I was born alcoholic or not. It doesn't make any difference. I just know from the very first memories I have of my childhood, I always felt like I didn't belong, wasn't a part of. And I grew up in the same house my mother grew up in, same house my granddad grew up in, went to the same school all they did. And I just never felt a part of that. You know, I just never felt comfortable. I always wanted to be somebody else. We lived in a farm up in the Finger Lakes region of New York, which is a beautiful, beautiful place, and I just hated it. And there was a farm across the street where my best friend, my oldest friend, even to this day, a guy named David White lives, or he lived then. And I can use his name because David's not an alcoholic. I always wanted to be, when I was a child growing up, I always wanted to be David White. First place, he had two parents that I liked. I didn't like my parents. You know, I was always ashamed of my parents for some reason. I don't know why. When I got sober, I finally figured out that my father was probably the most wonderful man that I've ever met in my life. My mother was a great gal. But I wanted David's parents, Homer and Cornelia. And David and I played in the high school band together, junior high band. Junior played trumpet, and I played sax. I always wanted to play the trumpet, just like David did. I don't know why. I couldn't play the sax. I don't know why I thought I'd play the trumpet. But... And I knew the kids hated me. During practice, one time I went to the bathroom, which seemed to be something I do a lot of lately. But And when I came back, I picked the sax up, and they were playing. I went to blow it, and somebody had stuffed a rag in the neck of my alto sax. And I damn near blew the top of my head off trying to play it. And I knew all those bastards hated me. You know? And I thought to myself, I'll get even. You know? And I think I still was thinking about that the day I got sober. You know? Of course, I never did. You know? And when I was about 12 years old, we moved into the city. I knew it was going to be different. A big city we moved into. 35,000 maybe. I was there less than 24 hours. It's the same damn place. I didn't fit in. The only thing I really liked to do is play sports. I used to love to play baseball. It's the only place I ever really felt somewhat comfortable was playing a little ball. I thought I could play baseball. I don't know if anybody else that thought I could play it very well, but I tried to do that for a while. And, I played American Legion ball, school ball. When I was 15, we used to hang around an ice cream parlor after practice on summer nights. I know I'd go in there with the guys, but I was so uncomfortable. And sometime in July, the end of my ninth year in school, one night after playing baseball, we went in there, and there's some guys hanging around. They're all older than I was. Most of the guys that are playing American Legion ball was 16, 17, and 18, and I was 15. They was all going to a ball in a couple of weeks, and someone asked me if I'd like to go with her, and I'd never been on a date, and I'd never been to a dance. I'd always wanted to do that, but I just never could, you know, just never could dance. I was one of those guys at the high school dances on Friday night after the basketball games, used to see leaning up underneath the backboards, making fun of everybody else who was dancing, you know. And I really, you know, I always wanted to dance, but I couldn't. I just had to stand there and make fun. And this girl asked me if I'd like to go to the dance with her, and I said, sure. I didn't know who she was. And I'd seen her around. She was attractive. And so I showed up the following Saturday night, met a group of them. Believe it or not, it was a Police Benevolent Association ball, which was going to become rather, I don't know how you could term it, but kind of apropos for what happened later in my life. And we got to the stands. We sat at a table. There was eight of us there. And the other seven ordered a rum coke. And I didn't think baseball players drank. I don't know why I thought that. Of course, I don't know why I thought most of everything I thought in those days. I've had grown up in a church, and I thought God and religion was full of hellfire and brimstone. I don't know where I got that idea. I don't know whether somebody told me that or it originated back here in my sick mind. Probably originated back here in my sick mind where most everything else, every other thought I had did. But these guys all ordered rum coke. I just wanted to be part of the crowd. So my first drink that I ever drank, I had it so I could be part of, so I could fit in. And I took that rum coke, and I don't know if I sipped it or I drank the whole thing down. It doesn't make any difference because in 15 minutes, I felt just as good as anybody in that room. Maybe 20 minutes, I don't know. But after drinking the rum coke, and I had no more intentions that night of having more than one rum coke than I do of going out here and playing on I-5 after the meeting's over with tonight. But after drinking that rum coke, I felt, Jesus. Phew. And that's the way it was for the next 14 and a half years. You see, I could take a drink of alcohol. Just kind of even everything out. And I turned and looked next to me, this girl that asked me to dance, or asked me to come to the dance with her, she had red hair and peaches and cream skin and hazel eyes. And she was wearing a pink chiffon dress. This kind of tells you where I come from. This was 1949. I still remember it. and I asked her to dance. And we got up and danced. When I came back, I don't know how many more rum cokes I had. And that doesn't make any difference. But what is important is that the first drink I had changed my perception of reality. Just like that. Bingo. I didn't know what was happening. I had no idea. And after taking the first drink that night, and every night after that I drank, I could never guarantee how much I was going to drink. Because I only intended to have that one drink. And sometime 2 or 3 hours later, the lights went out. And in the meantime, I don't know if I had 2 or 3 more or 8 or 10 more. I have no idea. I just knew I came through the following Saturday morning, sick, sorry, and sad. About 8 or 9 o'clock, and I wandered off to this ice cream parlor we played. We used to hang around at it after we got out of practice. And this lady I was with, her name was Joanne, and she was working behind the counter, and most of the guys that I'd been with the night before, and people were there in the restaurant. I slithered up to the counter, like only I can slither. And she came on over, and she said, "Hey, Glenn, how you doing?" And I'd shared that I was absolutely positive I'd passed out and puked on somebody's shoes or did something like that. And I said, "Gee, did I act up last night?" She said, "Oh, Glenn, don't you remember? You had a great time. You're a hell of a guy." And quite frankly, whatever else I tell you about my drinking the next 14 and a half years is hearsay, because I was a blackout drinker. And I had some fun with alcohol for a while. It took me a lot of places. It did some stuff, but it's somewhere down the line it started doing to me. And by the time I was 24, I was married with 3 or 4 children. And unemployable. And I grew up in a small town, and as I told you, things were different in the 50s. It was maybe a little softer, gentler, or maybe it was harder and crueler, I don't know, but it was different. And now I've got arrested a number of times in the 50s, but rather than book me at the police station in this small town, because my family, I come from a good family, hard-working people. My parents have lived in that part of New York since the 1780s. We've lived in New York since the 1600s. No history of any problem, just honest, hard-working people that grew up and got married and had children, paid their taxes, and lived a good, wholesome life. There's no history of alcoholism in my family. Until I come along. And I'm not sure there's any more after me. I got a couple sons that drink too much, but they don't think they're alcoholic. And the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells me that I don't have the right to make that determination for them. All I know is that there come a time in my life when I couldn't drink and work too. And I'd get arrested, and the police would put me in their car and take me home. Sometimes they'd leave a note, stop down the circuit court and pay your $25 fine Monday morning. And that's the way it went until I was 25 years old. And one morning I woke up and I was in the city jail. And I'd been arrested for burglary. Now, this wasn't my first experience with burglary. However, it was my first experience of robbing a produce store that was owned by a policeman. And I was accused of stealing $13.50 and 2 packs of L&M cigarettes. I have 2 pieces of advice I'll give out, and it's the last 2 pieces of advice I'm going to give tonight. A, never rob a policeman. B, never smoke L&M cigarettes. Then I was taken before a judge, and that was a big deal at Auburn, New York in 1959. I was placed in. The judge had gone to college with my father, and he was a great guy. And he told me how much of a problem I had been and had with alcohol. And he placed me on 5 years probation and ordered that I don't drink anymore. And I can vaguely remember that morning. And it was in November of 1959 in the Cougar County Courthouse in Auburn, New York. And I knew Judge Jerry Hewitt. He was a nice man. And I told Judge Jerry Hewitt that morning I'd never take another drink as long as I lived. And he said, "I hope so, because you don't seem to be able to handle alcohol." And I believe honestly, and I said it before you, that I was as honest that day when I said I'm never going to drink again, as I am tonight. But within 30 or 60 days, I just, one day I found me in a bar picking up a beer. And you say, that's the story of my life with alcohol. I'd stay sober for as long as I could stand that world out there. And then I'd pick up a drink. And I'd drink for as long as I could drink. Because after picking up the first drink, the craving for alcohol would set in. And I couldn't guarantee how much I was going to drink. And I'd drink for as long as I could drink. And then I'd get sober. And I'd stay sober as long as I could stand that world out there, as long as I could stand me. It's my experience that if there's anyone here tonight that's having a problem drinking alcohol, and they get into problems with alcohol when they drink, and all of a sudden you quit drinking and all your problems go away, I wish you the best of luck. Everything, just hang around here for 30 days and go on about life. But if you have a little problem when you drink, you get into problems when you drink alcohol, and you quit drinking, and the world turns to crap. They call that alcoholism. And we've got an answer for that here. It's called Alcoholics Anonymous. And after I went through this little exercise with Judge Jerry Hewitt for a couple of years, I was violated from probation. I never really counted. It's like when I drank. I only have one experience. I knew how much I drank one night. I was drinking with a friend in a nearby city. I'd called him. He was happened to be a member of the police department in Syracuse, New York. We played some baseball together. And I was over in his town about 4 o'clock. I'd hang around a bar, and I thought I'd give Don a call and see if he wants a drink. We were living in the same apartment building, and he'd just getting off shift. So he met me at a bar, and kind of a sleazy joint. He suggested we go to a respectable tavern. And I remember the drinking law there was 2 o'clock, and I remember us leaving that place 20 after 2 or so and entering our apartment building and walking downstairs to get on the elevator to go up to the floor we lived on, and the lights went out. The next morning I came to like I always did, sick, sorry, and sad. I pulled it all together and got to work, and during coffee break, this policeman walked in, this friend of mine. He was on duty. He was wont to do that once in a while. He'd stop and see us. Because we were good friends. After everybody, the coffee break was over, he said, Glenn, can I talk to you a minute? And I said, sure. And when he left, he said, do you feel all right? And I said, yeah, I did. It was 9:30 in the morning. I was doing good. I sucked on some oxygen that morning. Cleaned the old cobwebs out. I felt as good that morning as I did every morning after being out the night before. I said, why? Would I do something dumb last night? He said, do you know how much you had to drink last night? And I said, no, I'm not into counting. He said, you had 64 highballs. So he said, you might think about toning that down a little bit. I didn't have the heart to tell him I'd had 8 or 9 before I met him. Anyway, one day after the 3rd or 4th or 5th violation from probation, I was taken back before Jerry Hewitt again. He said to me, no, Glenville, I'm going to send you someplace where you can't get your hands on any alcohol. That shows you how little he knew about stuff. He sends me to 5 years in penitentiary. And I mentioned that I don't know whether I mentioned before or not, at that time I was arrested. It wasn't the first time that I'd ever been involved in criminal activities. What I'm going to tell you next, I'm not proud of. Because of what happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm not ashamed of who I am tonight. But one of the things that the police had arrested me for and taken me home, and they'd talk to me about it, but they never booked me on it because of the kindness of some very nice people. I had been known to borrow some money from the local Catholic Church poor box from time to time. And when I got to this institution I was there maybe 60 or 90 days, and I was crossing the yard going someplace with a guard to do something or other. He was escorting me somewhere, and I seen a Catholic priest coming at me. His name is Father Jim Collins. And I knew Father Collins. He taught my wife in high school. I wasn't of his particular religion, but I knew Father Jim pretty good. And he'd been a parish priest in my hometown for 4 or 5 years. And at the time, he was a Catholic chaplain at Elmira penitentiary. And he came right over to me and he said, Loister, I heard you were here. I'd like to talk to you sometime if you'd like to talk to me. And I thought, I bet you would. Because at the time there was a guy, bishop at the Rochester Diocese in New York, named Fulton Sheen. And I knew that Fulton, the bishop had called Father Collins and said, that poor box Robin Loister's down in your place, get the SOB, you know. And I also was gave some great information by an old convict that was in the county jail while I was waiting to be transferred to this institution. He gave me a couple pieces of advice. One of the things I still use today, he told me that when you have your head in the lion's mouth, you never ever kick it in the ass. I think that's a great piece of advice. He also told me that when I got to this institution, I should join everything in sight because it would look good on my record when I give up for parole. And being a shucker and a jiver, I thought of some quality. My current sponsor tells me I'm a lousy shucker and a jiver. He said, I'm a professional whiner and sniveler is what I am. Anyway, I put a note in to go see this Father Collins. I just knew he was going to cream my clock. I knew a little bit about him, as I told you. He'd been a middleweight boxer at Notre Dame in his undergrad days. And I walked in, and he offered me a chair, and he just chatted with me for 4 or 5 minutes. One of his best friends was a guy I'd played some baseball for, and he asked me about Barney. And then very casually, he said to me, Loister, do you have any idea why you're here? And I mumbled a whole bunch of stuff. I think I talked kind of loudly about the $13.50 and 2 packs of L&Ms. But I also said something about the poor boxes at St. Mary's Church. And as I remember the incident, he damn near went into hysterics. And he said something to the effect that if I got my booze out of a Catholic Church poor box, I must have drank awful cheap wine. And then he reached into a drawer and he pulled out a file. And alcoholics of my kind, they always have a file on you. You know, it's never very big. The truth, man, we always tell it's, you know, 47,000 arrests. And I had maybe 18 or 20 arrests, I don't know. And he said it noted by the arresting officer on every time there had been a file claimed on me for arrest file. The arresting officer had always noted, appears to be under the influence. And that might have something to do with it. And they didn't hold a meeting to that institution at that time because the warden didn't believe that anyone under the age of 30 could be an alcoholic. But Father Collins said he had written the governor of New York, and he was sure this was 1961 sometime. And shortly thereafter, they started a meetings to this institution. I started to attend meetings. And I have to tell you the honest truth that I was secretary of that group in 1963, the early part of 1963 when they had their first anniversary. I can't remember a thing that went on at those meetings. I remember a guy that used to come in named Joe Grace. He was the outside contact, and Joe had been sober 5 years, or about that amount of time. But you see, I didn't go to those meetings to get what it was you wanted. I went to those meetings to get the hell out of that place. I didn't care what it was what you had. I didn't go to that place to get what you had. I went to that place to get the hell out of there. And, you know, I tell that story. I've been telling that story for over 40 years now. And with the couple exceptions, I get exactly the same response. And nothing. I'm not sure anybody's alive out there when I tell this story. But a couple of years ago, I was Lompoc, penitentiary in Southern California. And I told that story. And those guys lit up like Christmas trees, you know. They knew exactly what I was talking about. And on August 22nd, 1963, they released me from Elmire Penal Institution, gave me $20 and a please don't rain on me suit and a bus ticket out of town. And when I left that institution that morning, I had no more idea of having a drink that day. And then it wasn't even in my mind anywhere. We got to the bus depot and I had about an hour and a half to wait. I looked over the corner and there was a bar there. And I walked over and I ordered a beer just while I wait for the bar, or wait for the bus to come. I don't remember much about the next 4 months, so I wasn't drunk the whole entire 4 months. But I was as much as I could. I lived on the streets. And I do what people like, alcoholics like me, do when you live on the streets. I came to on December 29, 1963, sitting on a bar stool in Syracuse, New York. I can't tell you much what was different about that day than any other day in my life in the previous 7 or 8 years. Unless I quote from Chapter 11 of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. In Chapter 11, it talks about alcoholics of my kind not being able to envision life without alcohol. And it says, sooner or later, we will not be able to envision life with alcohol or without. And it talks about it being at a place of loneliness that few human beings other than alcoholics of our kind ever experience. And it goes on to say that we're at the jumping off point. And that's where I was on that evening in December 29, 1963. And I got up from that bar and I walked out. And I came to as sober physically, it seems, as I am tonight. And I have no idea where I was 2 or 3 weeks prior to that. I'd come to sitting on a bar stool having a drink. The next thing I know, it was a day or two later, and I'm riding down the road on a railroad train, just pulling into maybe a station in Rochester, New York, or Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And I go into the bar in the railroad station, have a couple drinks. And the next thing I know, I'm in Messina, New York. That's the way I lived the last 3 or 4 months I drank. And I walked out on the streets from this Gotchkar's Warren Street Grill, and this policeman that I told you about with that I'd had those drinks that night, Don Goodrich, came walking down the street. He was on duty that night. And he came right up to me, and I said, "Hey, Don, how you doing?" He said, "A lot better than you are." And I said, "I suppose you know I'm on a drunk." And he said, "Yeah, there's a 16-state alarm out for your arrest." And I said, "Will you arrest me so I can get off this drunk?" He said, "No, you got yourself into this. You get yourself out of it." And he walked down the street, and I've never seen Don since. That tells you what a big-time drunk I was, what a big-time criminal I was. I couldn't even get arrested, for Christ's sakes. You know? And as I remember the night, it was 38 degrees below zero, but I'm sure it was, 10 or 15 degrees above zero, colder than hell. So I went to the county jail, knocked on the door, and asked them if they could find a warrant for my arrest. You know what you call that? You call it hopelessness. There wasn't a hope in the world. The only thing, someplace way back deep here, I could remember a guy named Joe Grace saying things like, "Hey, it may never sober you up, but sure as all hell go about stuff you're drinking." Back when I was a little new around AA, and I hadn't had quite as much contact as I have with the program recoveries I have tonight, when I tell this story, I used to say I had to wait out of the steps for 2 or 3 hours till they found a warrant. It was 2 or 3 minutes, probably, or something like that. And as I just said, I did stuff that last 3 or 4 months on that drunk that alcoholics of my kind do. And I already owed the state 3 years on the current sentence I was doing. I was consciously aware that if I was prosecuted, I'd be doing another 10 to 20 anyway. And the day after I got in there, my parole officer showed up. And he said, "How would you like to get out of here?" He said, "You have to go back to your home group and tell me one more time you won't drink." I said, "I'll give it a try." And he let me out, and he shipped me back to another parole officer. And that parole officer gave me a ride home. And it was a Wednesday. I believe it was the first Wednesday in January of 1964. That I'm not sure of. Again, I wasn't taking too many records in those days. I just didn't count it awful well. And my parole officer gave me a few bucks and got me some welfare money. got me a job on working in the Department of Welfare for Auburn, New York. And I had to shovel snow for the Department of Public Works. They had this silly idea in Auburn, New York in 1964 that if somebody gave you money, you ought to work for it. Didn't that seems to be a, a scheme that's been long lost on our... Well, there goes another opinion. I'm sorry for that. Oh, well. And I went to the telephone because of what had happened on that last drunk I was on. I knew I was never going to be able to drink like normal folk. And I knew I couldn't exist out there without it. That's about all I knew. I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know anything about the disease of alcoholism. I just knew that I couldn't drink and I was in a whole bunch of trouble. And I'd gone to some meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in this penitentiary I was in, and there were some people like you that came into those meetings that had seemed to found an answer. So I called, I looked in the telephone book for a listing for Alcoholics Anonymous, and there wasn't any listing for Alcoholics Anonymous, so I called information. And being the big shot that I was, I couldn't ask for AA. I didn't want anybody in that town to know that I was going to hang out with a bunch of Skid Row bums. And never entered my mind. My name had appeared in papers in that very town as being sentenced to 5 years in the penitentiary. So I just asked for AA. I just couldn't say Alcoholics Anonymous. And a lady gave me a telephone number, and I dialed it. And I got the Automobile Club of America. And someplace in this hopelessness, I had a degree of sanity. So I called back, and there was a lady answered the telephone. And I asked her, was there a listing for Alcoholics Anonymous? And there, again, in my early days, I used to say it's the pause seemed like forever, but it was just a couple of seconds. And this lady operator said, is this Glenn Loyster? And it appears that I have a couple friends here tonight. They're dear friends for more than 30 years. I call them my storefront alcoholic friends. They're members of Al-Anon. incidentally, that's the only Al-Anon joke I do, because what I'm going to tell you next. See, this Catholic priest that I talked about at the institution, he was a very active member of Al-Anon. His brother was a sober member of AA. And this lady on the telephone, her husband was a member sometimes of the Auburn, New York group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Happened to be that particular night he was on a drunk. And she said to me, I don't know if there's any meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous listed. But I know there's a guy named Sam. She told me his last name. And I don't know if he's a member of AA or not, but I'll give you his telephone number and he can tell you where AA is, even if he doesn't go to AA. She lied to me. You know, I didn't realize that night that, you know, Al-Anons can lie. What the hell? They're not going to get drunk. If they do, it's not going to hurt them, you know. Not only did she know there's meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, the previous Friday night she'd been with her husband to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the guy, Sam, that she didn't know if he was a member of AA, he was her husband's sponsor, for Christ's sake. But her husband was on a drunk, and so I called old Sam up, and they had meetings on Tuesdays and Friday nights. And on the following Friday night, I attended what is my first meeting to this day after having what is to this day my last drink of alcohol. And I don't know much about the next couple months. I just went to meetings. I would work Tuesday to Friday in the Department of Public Works, and on Monday I'd look for a job, and Tuesday I'd go to a meeting. God, nothing changed. You know, I'd go in to be all you nice people there. You were well-dressed, and you were smiling, and you were laughing. And I was thinking about that tonight as I was sitting in front of the room. I sat here, and this is a wonderful group. I want to thank you for inviting me here. I was sitting up here in the front. I was listening to your laughter before the meeting. You know, the sweet song of AA. And your enthusiasm. Don't lose it. For God's sakes, don't lose enthusiasm. And Sam had this enthusiasm, and a couple other guys did at this meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I'd show up at the door, they used to say, I'd went to high school with one, or junior high with one of the guys. I said, high school? I never went to high school, so I couldn't have gone to high school with him. You'll hear rumors around today, particularly by people I sponsor, who tell you that I got kicked out of the 8th or 9th grade for not shaving. That's not true. It was the 10th grade. And this is a long story. But anyway, I'd go to these meetings on Tuesdays and Friday nights, and there'd be all this laughter, and you'd say you were dressed well and you had nice cars, and with the exception of this wife's husband, Jim, who was sick, sorry, and sad, and coming off a drink. You all were so happy. God, you made me want to puke, you know. He'd been sober maybe 6 months, or one guy had 5 years, and old Sam had 15. Peaches Crawford had 4 years. And there was a guy named Mike that had 32 beautiful white teeth, and he'd been sober 5 years. And when I'd walk in the door, he'd say, "Hey, kid, God, it's good to see you." And as I was leaving, he'd say, "Keep coming back, kid." And that's what brought me back. And I guess it was maybe 60 days. I don't know. Again, I wasn't counting. On a Friday night, I was awful tired. And I had to walk to this meeting. It was about a mile and a half from the projects I was living in. There wasn't any bus service after 6 o'clock, and these were 8:30 meetings. There were participation meetings. There were maybe 15 people attending these meetings in the county. And the nearest meeting was more than 30 miles away in Syracuse, New York. And I couldn't leave the county. There were just meetings on Tuesdays and Friday nights. There were participation meetings. Unless, of course, someone like you from out of town showed up and you had more than 30 minutes of sobriety. And we then became a speaker meeting. Just like that, bingo. But anyway, for this first 60 days, were participation meetings every night. And they started a little different than you did. And it was like there were 15 people for an hour and a half. And they'd read the 24-hour book. Don't tell my sponsor that. He'd have a heart attack. You know, it's not AA-approved literature. They'd read the thought for the day out of the 24-hour book. But then they had the 12 steps printed on a piece of paper, and they'd read those. And then they had ask anybody if they had a subject they wanted to talk about, hopefully from one of those two things. And that was meetings in Auburn, New York, 1964. And after a couple months of this, one Friday night, this guy named Mike, I told you, with the 32 beautiful teeth. See, what really teed me off, you see, I didn't have any teeth in those days. And he had 32 real ones, you know. And he was Irish. And he was a little guy. And I didn't like him much, because I'd seen him on the streets when I was drinking. I knew who Mike Corrigan was. He was another one of those Irish arrogant guys. He had a little smile in the corner of his face. Hick. Like all you Irish people have. What that says to us is, you know, we're better than you are. And you know why we think we're better than you are? Because God told us so. And that's the way I'd see this Mike. But he was so damn friendly. And I'd walk this mile and a half to this meeting, and then I'd walk home afterwards. It was cold. This was the end of February sometime. And on a Friday, this Friday night, he came up and he said, "Hey, kid, how you doing?" And I said, "It's going shitty, Mike." And he said, "What do you say we get down to Hunter's Diner and have a cup of coffee?" And I said, "I'm real tired. I shoveled snow all day." He said, "Yeah, I know. I seen you." He said, "I'll give you a ride home." And I said, "Mike, I live in Malone Village, a mile and a half away from here." He said, "I know where you live. I live right across the street from you." And then he said, before I had a chance to say anything, something that still guides me, even today. He said, "I suppose you want to know why I haven't asked you to ride before." And he didn't give me a chance to answer that. He never did. None of those sponsors, like the one I got now, asked me questions. They'd never give me a chance to answer. They ask me a question, then they tell me the answer. And he said, "Because I want to see how bad you wanted this." And for some reason, I intuitively knew what he was talking about. I was only 60 days sober. And went down to Hunter's Diner and sat there. I used to tell the story it was 2 hours. I don't know. Could have been an hour, could have been 3 hours. Doesn't make any difference. But as we were getting in the car and driving home this mile and a half, he turns to me and he said, "Hey, kid, it appears to me your thinking isn't too good. Maybe I ought to do it for you for a while." And I used to tell the story in my smart-ass days. that I thought to myself, why would I let any Irish SOB tell me what to do? That's not true at all. It's not true at all. I snapped an answer just like that. I said, sure. Because I knew he had something. While we were sitting in that diner that night, he never asked me a question, really. What Mike did that night was he told me what he used to be like, what happened, and what he was like now. He explained the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to me. And I hadn't the faintest idea what alcoholism was that night, because I hadn't read the big book. It was a long time before I did, incidentally. But I knew Mike had found something, and I knew that he was a power greater than myself. I didn't say that. You see, I believed that night in Syracuse that when I walked out of that bar that I surrendered, and I took the first step. Inevitably, that night, sitting in that coffee shop to Mike, even though I really didn't know, I begin to take the second step. To begin with, I never work steps. I've always been told to take the steps. It's an ongoing process. 41 years later, I'm still working on the steps. I'm still taking the steps tonight. I'm a long way from perfect. And I believe that night that I began to take the second step because I knew Mike had something. And he was a power greater than myself. I'm not suggesting for me that Mike was God. I knew he wasn't. I knew he was a guy just like me because I used to see him sitting on the bar stool from there. The next Tuesday night when we got to the meeting, Mike arranged for me to be coffee maker. He had one of those committee meetings they have, you know. He said, I think it would be a great idea for Glenn to be the coffee maker, don't you? Before I could say anything, they said, yeah. It was the greatest thing that happened to me next to getting to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous after having my last drink. Next 2.5 or 3 years, almost 3 years, I was the coffee maker for Auburn, New York on Thursday and Friday nights. And a week or so after that, Mike took me on my first 12-step call. See, what Mike did was he first got me into the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous. Then he slowly started me through the steps. Mike hadn't taken the steps the way it's suggested necessarily in the big book because he'd never read the big book. But what he did with me, he shared his experience, strength, and hope with me. And he'd read the steps off a piece of paper and applied them to his life as best he could. And he got me through, actually through into the ninth step. By the time I got a hold of my hands on a big book. And when I was maybe 4 months sober, they moved the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Gee, I'm driving them out already. I usually do this before this time. The last time I was invited to speak in Portland was 1978 at Obie's down here. I haven't been invited back since. Oh, well. Where was I? I was taking the steps with Mike, wasn't I?
Ninth step.
Thank you very much. I might have to go back there again before tonight's over, huh? Anyway, I was sort of 4 or 5 months. We used to have these meetings in the third floor of the only office building in town. The only 5-story office building in town. And when I was 4 or 5 months sober, they moved it, guess where? To the Catholic church that I had robbed. And I had to go make coffee there the first Friday night we were there. And I walked up the front door, and before I went there, I said to Mike, where do I get the keys? And he said, you go to the rectory and ask for them. And I thought, oh, shit. But I was kind of scared of Mike. I've always been a little bit scared of my sponsor. I'm a little bit scared of the sponsor I got today, and I frequently get resentments against him. I'll tell you what, if you don't get a resentment against your sponsor from time to time, you've got the wrong sponsor, kid. And my sponsor that I have today used to run the yard at San Quentin, not as an employee. And although he hasn't hurt anybody in over 44 years with his hands, old ideas hang around a long time. And that night, Friday night, we made coffee there. I went to the front door, the rectory, and I knocked on the door. And guess who came to the door? Monsignor Cuffney, who knew me very well. And I said to him, because I had read the steps. I knew what it said in the 8th and 9th. I didn't know nothing about it. But I knew about it. And I said, Monsignor Cuffney, I guess I probably ought to have a talk with you. I need the keys for the school because I'm the coffee maker for AA. Cuffney said, uh-huh. And I said, you know, I probably ought to talk to you sometime about some stuff that happened in the past. He said, I said to him, when would be a good time? He stood back from the door and said, right now. Now, I hadn't got much, I hadn't done a fourth or fifth step. And I don't recommend doing the steps out of order, but I had to start to do an eighth and ninth step that night. And, little did I know Mike had called Monsignor Coffey and told me he was coming. Oh, well. I was over a year and a half. One of those, I was trying to reunite with my wife and family. I had five children. And we was in an awful mess. And my wife just hated Alcoholics Anonymous. She didn't want me to drink and she didn't want me to be sober. And it was a mess. Because of my actions, our marriage was just terribly sick and it was unrepairable. And a year and a half after, I'm just about moving out. And one of those Friday nights when we had a visitor from California. Her name was Liz, and she was redheaded. And she'd been sober since October of 1957. She became our speaker that night. And it was 10 days before the 1965 conference of Alcoholics Anonymous in Toronto, Canada. And after the meeting was over with, I was back doing my duties, cleaning the bar, and she came back and talked with me. We talked about 10 or 15 minutes, and she talked about the Big Book a lot. She was California AA. They read the Big Book at California, especially in Santa Ana. At least in 1965 they did. And I said after a while, you know, I've never read the Big Book. And she damn near had a heart attack. And after collecting herself and getting out of there and flying to New York the next day, she was a friend of Bill Wilson's. And she went to New York, bought a Big Book, and airmailed it to me the next day. I have it in Rancho Mirage, California. So, second edition, second printing. I was so grateful to her, I married her 2 years later. And I got to California. It was probably the second greatest thing that ever happened to me. And I've been the luckiest guy on the face of the earth. When I was about two, I went to International Conference in 1965. And I rode up with a couple of people from my hometown, and we didn't have enough money to register, just enough for gas, so we snuck into Saturday night. Those days, they weren't quite as rigid as they are these days. And I stood in the open Toronto Maple Leafs arena and held hands while 10,000 people said the I Am Serenity Pledge. And the year after that, I went to New York and walked in Bill Wilson's office. He was there. And that following fall, I went to Bill's dinner and I heard him talk. And shortly after that, I moved to California. And I got there in October of 1966, just the Southern California Conference was going on. And I got to the Saturday night meeting, and there was a man that I wish was talking here tonight. His name was Norm A., Norm Alpe, which in my opinion is the greatest talker that ever came to AA. And I got to know Norm pretty good. And a couple of weeks later, I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in Santa Ana, and I heard a guy talk named Chuck C. And I had privilege to spend a few days alone with Chuck C. over the next 10 or 15 years. And this gal and I was married. She developed a little Valium deficiency. And we took a geographic cure, and I moved to Eugene, Oregon in 1971. And I lived there for 9 years. And that's where I really grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got there, and I was pretty desperate, and she was apparently more desperate than I was. She was having a lot of trouble. I've been there a couple of weeks, and I went to a meeting for Alcoholics Anonymous. There was a whole bunch of old-timers hanging around there. Every place, you know, you go in the United States, in the world, where there's AA, you'll find little pockets of good sobriety. I just found one of them tonight right here. But everywhere you go, there's AA. If you look, you'll find little pockets of alcoholic, good AA. And if you don't start it, and in Eugene in 1971 and 70, there was little pockets, small. You had to look real hard in Eugene. I was there yesterday. You got to look even harder today. There goes another goddamn opinion, you know, but oh well. That's my experience today, not my opinion, incidentally. And I went to this meeting after sitting around talking to this guy named Roy C. He'd been on 12-step call, another guy named Stuttering Jack, who was sitting next to me. And Roy was telling this story. He'd gone on a 12-step call the day before. And on the way to the 12-step call, Jack said to Roy, it was Roy's first 12-step call, Roy, you be the nice guy, I'll be the tough guy. And Roy said, what the hell are you talking about? Jack said, you be nice to him, I'll be tough. And according to Roy, they got to the door, and Jack knocked on the door, and a guy named Ben came to the front door. This is a true story. And Ben opened the door, and he had a bottle of I.W. Harper in his right left hand, and a .357 Magnum in his left. And Jack, the little Irish dude, turned around to Roy and said, Roy, why don't you be the tough guy? I was scared to death of Jack O'Connor. Scared to death. But I went over and asked him to be my sponsor. Next 8 years, I lived in Eugene, and Jack changed my life. He really got me involved in the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, as they are involved in this book, or written in this book here. And I went from being an unemployed truck mechanic to general manager of the universe in Eugene. The guy hired me down there to be a truck driver, and 2 years later, I was manager of his company. A year later, I was on the board of directors. 4 years later, he fired me. It's a long story, but he should have. I should have fired him before that. But only well. And he gave me a severance pay. I made a telephone call to Southern California. And on June 2nd, 1980, I moved to Walnut Creek, California. And I lived there for the next 22 years. And I had a wonderful time there. I just had a wonderful time. I like to tell you, since moving to Eugene, Oregon, in 1971, and meeting this guy and going to work at that company, I've never missed one day of work. I've never missed one day's pay in that 30 odd years. And I never held a job a year prior to that, coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I moved to the Bay Area, and I got reelected in the Bay Area and become a member of nursery group number 3 of our David. Anne wanted to belong there too, but they had some rather rigid restrictions. It's a stag group. And I was privileged to get involved with some of the finest people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I sponsor a whole bunch of people down that way. And I'd like to thank the people I sponsor for allowing me to do so, because they make me act a hell of a lot better than I really am. And I'm not trying to tell you, in the last 41 years, everything that's happened to me has been peaches and cream. Every day has not been a banquet. And the sun has not shone every day, you know. During that period of time, I've made an awful lot of money in the 70s. And I lost every damn dime of it in 1980. 1992, I was diagnosed with lung cancer and given 6 months to live. The doctor's dead, incidentally. I got involved in industry, and I stayed at a job, and I made a pretty good living for the next, after moving down there for the next 20 odd years. And this Liz, the lady I told you I married, after 30 years, she picked up a drink. We were divorced in 1986 and 7. She died drunk a few years later. A couple years later, I met a young lady some 17 years prior, my age, and one of the guys I sponsor came up to me and said, Glenn, people are talking. I said, they usually do. He said, well, they are. They say, I said, what are they saying? They say that you're rocking the cradle. And I said, about what? And they said, well, isn't the gal you're dating 17 years or younger than you are? At least a little younger? And I said, no, she's a lot younger. She's 17 years younger. He said, what should I tell him? I tell him, stay sober 23 years, maybe you'll get one too. I don't know. And we were married, and it worked wonderful for a long time. And about 7 or 8 years ago, she decided she had to do some other stuff. And, some of my friends didn't approve of some of the actions that were going on that she was doing. And I told her, I didn't either, but, She was a good member of AA. She's going to be talking here next week or next month. She's a great member of AA. And we've got through that. About a year after that divorce, what was it, 6-8 months? Something like that. I got pneumonia, and after being in the hospital a few days, they sent me home because they didn't know whether I was going to make it or not. And they thought I'd be more comfortable at home. I made it, incidentally. I may not be breathing too good tonight, but I'm breathing, kid. And so long as I keep breathing, I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing. And a couple, 3 or 4 years ago, I met a lady in the desert. I never move anywhere unless there's a lady. I'm going to give you one more opinion before I leave. My opinion is that women will draw alcoholics my kind a lot further than gunpowder will ever blow us. Well, that's the way it goes. About 2.5-3 years ago, I moved to the desert. That's sometimes referred to as God's waiting room. It's 70 years old. It may not sound good to you, but I'm in pretty good shape, guy. You know, because of Alcoholics Anonymous and loving God and good sponsorship, I'm doing great. You know, I've had better health days, but I got pretty good health. I'm earning more money than I've ever heard in my life. I'm 70 years old. I live in a great big house. I drive a great big car. I've got a beautiful lady in my life, and I've got a world full of friends. And if it were not for you, a loving God, good sponsorship and a program recovery called Alcoholics Anonymous and Fellowship, I'd miss the whole thing. And the only thing I got to say to you tonight is that my name's Glenn. And because of a loving God and good sponsorship and fine people like you, I haven't had a drink of alcohol since December 29, 1963. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.